invite you to open a New Testament and study with us this morning. We'll be looking at Luke chapter 14 primarily. Page 704 in the Pew Bible, Luke chapter 14. While you're turning there, let me share an additional announcement with you. Brandon Schott is scheduled for surgery November 29th at Vanderbilt Hospital in Nashville. The family requests prayers on his behalf. I know this surgery has been in the works for a long time, waiting on, insurance issues for one. But it's a fairly serious surgery. Brandon's a young man. I'm sure there's a great deal of anxiety that has been built up in him waiting and waiting and waiting for this to happen. And I'm sure that his family are concerned as well. I think this is going to be extensive jaw surgery. So there's going to be some difficulty involved in that, and probably, again, a lot of worry and anxiety. So let's keep Brandon and his family in our prayers. There are many things in this life that if we're going to accomplish are going to take a significant amount of sacrifice on our part. We have a number of students that are here with us and meet with us from year to year, some from Tech, some from Emory, some from Mercer, and I don't think any of those schools are pushovers academically. And so I can only imagine what it would be like to, at this point in your life, be sacrificing time away from your family, sacrificing a significant amount of money, investing that in your college education, the time that it takes to keep up with the rigorous studies in which many of our younger folks here are involved. Whether it's school or whether it's the job or whether there's some other meaningful objective that we're pursuing, the things in life that are most worthwhile often require the most from us. And so we must look at what these endeavors take and what they ask of us, and ask ourselves, are we willing to invest of ourselves and of our things in this life to accomplish those particular goals? In Luke chapter 14, Jesus is challenging, again, the multitudes that are following Him. In verse 25, great multitudes went with Him. For those in the Sunday morning class, we have already talked about the fact that earlier great multitudes were following Jesus, mostly up in Galilee. And in John chapter 6, he drew a line in the sand and made them make a choice. And basically he did it by asking them through difficult teaching, what are your deeper motives here in following me? And a lot of those people, when challenged, turned away and left the Lord. This is at a later time in his life, and he is in Perea, the area to the east side of the Jordan River. And again, great swelling crowds are following him, and he does something similar here that he did in John 6 with the earlier crowds. He puts them to the test. He's not interested just in numbers, and we need to remember that. He's not interested just in numbers. He's not interested just in a building full. And he's not interested merely in having a great retinue or a great crowd following after him to demonstrate in some carnal way his popularity. He's really interested in the hearts of men and their deeper motives in desiring to follow him. So he challenges the crowd in verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. We reserve the word hate for some very strong emotions, mostly negative ones. There are certain things we're to hate in this life, have a strong dislike or aversion toward, and they all have to do with things of the devil. But Jesus is using a term here that apparently, by the way that it's used, carries with it a relative value. Debbie Vine describes the word this way, relative preference for one thing over another. In other words, what I choose to put my time and attention, my effort, my concentration into, I'm hating all else. I'm forsaking other things for the sake of this thing that I have decided to put so much of my attention into. In Luke 16 and verse 13, Jesus says, "No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he'll be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." Relatively speaking, you're not going to put an equal balance of investment into two competing objectives. One is going to be selected at some point for the sake of the other. Your heart is just going to be given more to one than to another. Over in John chapter 12, you notice Jesus said in verse 26, "You must hate your own life also." What does he mean by that? You must hate your own life. John chapter 12 and verse 25, "He who loves his life will lose it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life." The idea is that we need to be properly focused on the right thing. And relative to other things, other important things, we need to put Jesus first. Again, Luke 14, 26, if anyone comes to me, there are great crowds following him. But Jesus says, if you really want to come to me, you must, relatively speaking, give up your family, give up your own selfish pursuits, give up your own objectives, not abandon entirely, but I must come above all of those other things. We're going to continue to have responsibilities to our family, obligations to love them, not hate them, love them and care for them and serve them. We're going to have other things that we're going to do in this life that are a result of our personal desires or ambitions. But what puts it together in the proper order is that we have the Lord first. I must come first. Relatively speaking, in terms of priority, you must hate, in the sense the term is used in the New Testament writings, you must hate all else. You must think less of everything else but me. Even your own life. Especially your own life in this world. The things that attach to worldly living and the objectives and the goals that have to do with the here and now, we must subject those to the goals that have to do with the Lord. Now, keeping a finger in Luke 14, turn back to Matthew chapter 10. Jesus has some similar teaching here. And this is relative to what is going to happen sometimes regarding our families, our this world relationships. Matthew 10, verses 34 and following. "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." That's not an expression of desire. That's an expression of reality. Jesus says, if I demand, and I do, to be placed first, that's going to bring you into conflict with a lot of other things. Thus, a sword is going to be brought into the world, and a sword is going to be brought into our lives when we do choose to follow Jesus. "For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me," there's the idea of hate in the biblical sense. "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." I recently was speaking to some friends in Hueytown, Alabama, where I was before here. And there were some teenage kids, younger teenagers when we were there, whose parents were not Christians, but they were allowed to come to worship with their friends and their family. And now that they've gotten to be older teens, and the parents, I suppose, have realized this wasn't just a passing fad, that they had continued to worship and continued to go to Bible classes and enjoyed it, the parents have drawn a line in the sand for those kids and basically said, "You cannot go to the Hueytown Church anymore." It's really broken the hearts of a lot of people there to have unbelieving parents step in and say to their children who are still under their control as parents and under their authority, you cannot go anymore. We're going to be asked by the world, because of its insistence and its opposition to spiritual things, we're going to be asked to pay a price to follow the Lord and to follow Him with all the fullness that He wants to be followed with. And Jesus makes this very clear. He speaks in very plain terms. If anyone does not place me first, he cannot be my disciple. In Matthew 10, as we just read, his phrase was, is not worthy of me. What a statement for a man to make. You must sacrifice all relationships, if necessary, for me. You certainly must place me before all relationships. And if you don't, you're not worthy of me and you can't be my disciple. What's involved in the one who's making that claim? And what's going to be our response to that demand? Back in Luke chapter 14, let's continue into verse 27. Whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. A cross, of course, in that time, was an instrument of execution. Horrible execution. Painful and suffering in what it inflicted upon those who were dying upon it. And while it may be literally that in coming to Christ, we're going to be bearing and even being placed on a cross. That is, there may be physical consequences to following after Jesus. I think essentially what he's saying here is there must be the death of self. There must be the death of self-interest and the death of self-will. You must be willing to take up the instrument of execution and allow yourself to be placed on that. As painful as it would be to be put on a real cross, sometimes it's that painful to say no to ourselves in regard to certain sins, certain temptations, certain desires, to face ourselves and say, I must give that up. I must sacrifice that to the Lord. Back again in Matthew, but this time in chapter 16 instead of chapter 10. Matthew chapter 16, Jesus again speaks very pointedly about discipleship and about the cost of discipleship. Matthew chapter 16 and verse 24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Let him deny himself and take up his cross. Again, to put self to death and say no to oneself. And if we're not willing to bear his cross and come after him, he says, you cannot be my disciple. Again, very, very plain language. He is challenging these people as to their deeper motives in following after him. And he's not one to just throw out a few nice words to draw people in and then hope that the harsh reality, when it finally sets in, will not drive them away. Jesus wants everyone to know up front what is involved in being his disciple. Again, back in chapter 14 of Luke in verse 33, he says it this way. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has, who does not forsake all that he has, cannot be my disciple. And he's putting this about every which way he can put it to make it clear. As we talked about even in class this morning with the Pharisees, they were so materialistic. They were lovers of money. And so Jesus in Luke chapters 15 and 16 tells six parables in those two chapters. Tells parables that are directed at breaking through the material outlook of the Pharisees. They had so come to cherish things, they had lost sight of their fellow man. And even had lost sight of the Son of God who was in front of them. And so Jesus says, what you have must be mine. Your will must be mine. Everything that you desire must be submitted to me and to my will, or you cannot be my disciple. Because Jesus is speaking in this strenuous and very strict way about following Him, in the middle of this discussion about what it takes to be His disciple, He throws in an illustration of thinking before you commit. And He says in verse 28, "For which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going to make war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace." He tells two stories here. One having to do with humiliation. You invest yourself into a project, you start something that's expensive, you can't finish it, and look at all the waste. And everybody's going to see that, and they're going to realize, there's a guy that didn't have a lot of forethought. On the other hand, he tells a short parable that has more at stake than one's pride. And go into battle outnumbered, without thinking that whether with a reduced force you can overcome the army that's greater. Think about the commitment. Think about what you're getting into before you take an ill-advised leap into following after me as a disciple. You ever started a project that was more than what you bargained for? You have some projects laying around your house or maybe in the garage or maybe out of sight so we're not reminded of what we started, and there it is, still unfinished. Again, when I was in Hueytown, there was the perception on the part of the county in which we were located that the county school system was not giving our side of the county its due. And apparently, though we hadn't lived there all that long, but apparently the western side of Jefferson County had been passed over financially in view of the up-and-coming communities on the east side of Jefferson County. And so the school was pretty much in disrepair, and there were other issues that needed to be addressed. And so some folks in the community got together and decided they would pick a committee to try to lobby the county to get equal representation on our side of the county. Well, yours truly got put on that committee. And once we got into the process of trying to be influential in a positive way with the school board, we began to realize how powerful the government can be at stonewalling you. And it came down to having to make trips regularly across the county to meet at the Board of Education at the times that, you know, weren't always regularly scheduled meetings, and phone calls not returned. And then we also ran into the problem of, even though the community wasn't all that happy about the school system, there really wasn't very much of a commitment to really investing in it what needed to be invested to try to change that. And the fellow that was the president of the committee that I was on, his mother got sick and was very, very ill, and so he was distracted with her, so there wasn't really a lot of leadership, and after a while it just fizzled, which is probably what the county wanted anyway. But the point is, when we got involved in that as a community, there wasn't a real good understanding of how difficult that whole process was going to be. And there was a lack of total and complete commitment. The fact of the matter was, in that situation, I was more committed to my spiritual duties than I was to civic issues. And so I probably didn't carry my load either. I hated the one and cherished the other, as it were, the two masters. What to me was more important was my work for the Lord than trying to lobby the school board. And so it went nowhere. The point being that when it comes to our discipleship to the Lord, Jesus is saying this takes top priority. This absolutely must come first. It must come before the rigors of school. It must come before the hardships of work. It must come before the frivolous entertainments of this life, the things that come along in a place like Atlanta with all kinds of social and entertainment activities on offer. There's so much to do in Atlanta that it might be difficult, at least in our minds sometimes, to give to the Lord what is His due, and easy to be distracted by the other things that this life has to offer. The standards of the Lord are so high that the tendency becomes on our part to substitute something else for full and total commitment. And I think one of the things that can be so deceptive that we substitute for true commitment to the Lord is local church membership. By that I mean that we can go to the elders and we can say, I want to be a member of this local church. And they'll probably ask us a question or two to sort of see where we're coming from theologically, what our understanding of certain things are. But if we pass the test, we're granted fellowship in the local church. And if we're here for a little while, we might be here long enough for a directory revision, so we get our picture and our address and our phone number in the directory. And we will then feel an obligation, certainly, to be here on certain occasions. And so we are here periodically, and maybe if we really make an effort, we'll make a circle of friends in the local congregation. We'll find a niche where we fit in, and this is working out pretty good now. Because I'm a member of the Ember Hills Church of Christ, and I'm in the directory, so if Mom asks about it in Timbuktu, I can say, I'm in the directory. And we got friends, and we are here enough that nobody comes knocking or calling very often. And so what can happen to us over time is we begin to confuse being a member of the Ember Hills Church of Christ with being a devoted, committed disciple of the Lord. And I'll tell you, it's a lot easier to keep up church membership, a presence in the local family. It's a lot easier to keep that up if we have indeed other interests than it is to be completely committed and devoted to the Lord. Local church membership does not equal discipleship. The Lord is asking for a higher place than that. And the real question is not, are you committed to the Lord's people? The question is, are you committed to the Lord? And if you're committed to the Lord, you're going to be committed to the Lord's people. I want you to take out your psalm books and turn to the invitation psalm, but we're not quite there yet. I want you to turn to number 268. I think Marty led this song a couple of weeks ago, and I'll confess, really, that it's the thoughts of this song that led to the thoughts of the sermon today. Sometimes you can sing a song, and it doesn't strike you in a certain way, and you might sing it dozens of times. And then one time you'll sing it, and you'll begin to ask yourself some things that maybe you didn't ask yourself before. And for whatever reason, I don't know what those reasons or that reason was, but when we sang this song, the question really stuck in my mind, what have you given for me? I gave my life for thee, my precious blood I shed, that thou might ransomed be and quickened from the dead. I gave my life for thee. What hast thou given for me? My Father's house of light, my glory-circled throne, I left for earthly night, for wanderings, sad and lone. I left it all for thee. Hast thou left aught for me? I mean, the question he's asking us here is, what price have you paid to be my disciple? What have you sacrificed to be my disciple? And I'll tell you, brethren, from the standpoint of local church membership, it's just real easy to be a disciple of the Lord. In our country, we're not like the brethren in Zimbabwe that have to walk 14 miles to meet under a tree. or the brethren in India that have to literally face tigers and cobras, some of whom have been killed on the way to worship? Does the ease of our country make us stronger disciples in our commitment? Or does it tend to weaken us just by the nature of things? I suffered much for thee, more than thy tongue can tell, of bitterest agony to rescue thee from hell. I've borne it all for thee. What hast thou borne for me? And I have brought to thee down from my home above salvation full and free. My pardon and my love. I bring rich gifts to thee. What hast thou brought to me? What does it cost you to be a Christian? And if not cost us in terms of persecution, what are we bringing? What are we offering week by week? What is it that the Lord receives from me when I come before Him in worship, or I come before Him in study, or I come before Him in prayer? I believe we sang a song this morning, I think it was 565, that asked some of those same questions. What is it we're bringing to the Lord? Well, the lesson this morning is not merely about attending worship as we should, although it's an illustration of the deeper point we're trying to make. But how do you decide on coming to worship or Bible study? What sorts of conversations do you have in your own mind? And what sort of things might hinder the times when we can be together with God's family and as a group come before God in prayer and in memorial of the Lord's death, in singing, in concentrating on a unified message from His Word as we're doing now? Life is busy and hectic and difficult. Again, our students, you're under a tremendous strain. There's just no two ways about it. It's a tremendous strain. But so are the people who hold down 40 and 50 and 60 hour a week jobs and are raising children and have ill parents to care for here or elsewhere. I mean, life is demanding. Even in a country as convenient and developed as ours, life is demanding. And so do you reason within yourself, I'm just so worn out. I just don't, I got to get ready for tomorrow. The tests are coming. The paper is due. The back to work. The grind begins all over again. I am just worn out either by what the thought of what's coming or what I was doing last night till whatever hour. Well, I haven't seen these folks in a long time, and they're in town. And I don't want them to feel slighted in any way. So I really think, I can be with the brethren anytime, but I have company. I just really don't get that much out of it, so missing one's not going to hurt. I'm kind of there. And I really don't seem to leave with a lot, so no big deal to miss one. I don't fit in anyway. I just really don't feel comfortable, and I haven't found my niche, and folks don't speak to me, and blah, blah, blah. That just doesn't get it. Anything starting with I just doesn't get it. Because the deeper issue is the commitment that I have to the Lord. It's not my commitment to the job or school or sports or anything else. It's the commitment I have to the Lord. Do you ever say to yourself, the Lord is expecting me? He will know if I'm not there, whether the elders will pay any attention or not, or anybody else will notice because I don't fit in. Whether or not I get a phone call about why I was not there, the Lord expects me to be there. And it's fellowship with Him first and foremost. Secondarily, the brethren. The Lord died for me to enable me. It's not a burden. To enable me to come and worship and study and reflect on His death and contribute as a grace. Paul calls our giving a grace, a favor that God is giving us to give of our means. And the Lord died. I gave my life for thee. What have you given to me? The Lord has top priority in my life. Thus, whatever else is going on in my life, this is where I belong. This is what comes first. These are the people that I must be with first and foremost. That's the proper way to look or to deliberate at whether it's attending worship or whether it's any other spiritual challenge that we have in this life. What's the deliberation process we go through in deciding in this moment, in this opportunity, what am I going to do? And who is the decision going to focus around? If we enthrone the Lord in our hearts to begin with, as He is demanding here in Luke 14, if we fully committed ourselves to the Lord first, these other issues will not be matters of debate. We will have settled those things at the start when we committed ourselves to Him. And let me ask you this question as we draw our thoughts to a close. If it's something like the assembly and attending, if I'm debating that, if that is not an automatic, if that's not a given in my life, that this is where I am when the doors are open, the brethren are meeting, this is where I am. If I struggle with that, how am I going to deal with materialism? How am I going to deal with carnal enticements? If we can't handle the simple things, which is what Jesus says to the followers in John 6, if you're tripping over this, what would you do if I told you, or if you saw where I came from before here? If you can't handle this spiritual truth, what would you do with a greater one? If you can't handle this challenge, what would you do with a greater one? And if the little things are matters of debate, whether it's attending the assembly or some other thing that's just a light obligation, how well are we doing with the deeper challenges that come with being the Lord's disciple? So as we close, I want us to think in our own minds and our own hearts about the question that the Lord is asking us. In fact, I think I had something else to show you here. Ask ourselves the question, what am I willing to sacrifice for the Lord? And is my discipleship to Him a matter of sacrificing anything? Or have I so worked this thing out to where what I give to Him really doesn't hurt? I serve out of convenience. I serve out of ease. I serve so as it not to make it a more strenuous element of my life on top of everything else. What are you willing to sacrifice to the Lord? And what the Lord's telling us is you must sacrifice it all. It all must be given to my service and devotion and commitment to the relationship you sustain with me. Can we help you answer this question in a positive way while we stand and sing?